Their love is in line with the groping affinities of the inanimate world, it crowns the obscure forces of sentient life, it is a free expression of biological instinct. In their love, a man and woman become part of the great creative urge that runs through all of the universe. As Germaine Flammonde writes, in giving themselves to each other they fall in step with the rhythm of the universe. Married couples can, furthermore, understand the immense social implications of their vocation. The family is the basic cell of society. This is primarily true because marriage can give one thing no social institution can give, and yet which every social institution needs, love. The family is the source of love. It generates those spiritual forces such as an understanding and respect for others, the ideal of service and a sense of the sacred values that unite men and subsequently, through the children, pumps these forces into society. A society that cannot depend upon this source of vitality withers in violence and solitude. Unless the love that is communicated from heart to heart in the sanctuary of the home influences society, the purpose of life becomes horribly vitiated. When the sense of love disappears, the meaning of both God and man is lost. Just as the family is the cell of society, so too is it the cell of the church. The love which the church endeavors to disseminate into the world is cultivated first of all in the family. The harvests of charity in the kingdom of heaven will be in direct proportion to what the family has sown in the heart of the child. That is why the greatest hope of the church today is the apostolate of the family. Unless the family is Christian, there will be no apostles to answer the call of supernatural love. Unless the family is Christian, there will be no Christian world. Thus all of life, human and divine, enters into the notion of love. We can measure the success of our lives and the strength of our personalities by our success in love. Upon this depends our personal happiness, our social influence and our spiritual progress. Questions. I. What are some modem attitudes towards love and marriage? 2. In what way does married love include the universe itself? 3. What is the family's unique contribution to society? 4. Point out how this contribution is lacking in modern American society. 5. What is the order of dependence between the church and the family? 6. What practical steps can be taken to intensify love? Discuss. I. The greater a man is, the deeper is his love. 2. Love gives unity and purpose to life. 3. The complete human being is the couple. 4. The highest relationship between the sexes is a spiritual one. Chapter A. The Splendor of Human Hove Synopsis. Love in marriage can be distinguished from other kinds of love. The three basic characteristics of this love are, first, it unites two people of different sexes, second, it unites them irrevocably in view of a common good and the foundation of a family, third, it is a sacramental love. We may note also that the love which attracts a man and a woman derives from a deeply human appetite. It is, furthermore, a love of choice which can be at once disappointing and idealistic. It can be disappointing because illusions to which love tends to give rise cannot withstand the reality of married life. Where two people are concerned, there can be no total communion. In every satisfaction lurks a sentiment of unfulfillment. This love is idealistic because those who share it nourish the hope that this gift they share will lift them above the trials and tribulations of the workaday world and carry them back to the freedom and innocence of Eden. For a mature grasp of what constitutes love in marriage, certain dangers must be guarded against. The first danger is that of egoism. Two people who love each other can be just as selfish as one person who loves himself. Another danger is that of reaching satiety in marriage, a too sudden realization that human love is not a panacea. One effective antidote to these dangers is the realization that love is not an escape from the world. This new society which a man and woman begin in marriage does not sever them from others. They cannot renounce their ties with other people. Rather, they must understand that, far from isolating them, their love binds them more closely to the past. It also opens a door on the future. Married couples must always be in a state of expectancy. They await the arrival of their children. They await, too, the consummation of their love in heaven. In the meantime, they grow more deeply aware of how closely their love joins them to God. They develop a keen sense of God's presence in their love for each other. At this point is discovered another antidote against the dangers that threaten their marriage. For couples who are aware of the spiritual dimension of their marriage will gradually understand that their vocation is subject to God's law just as their union is a reflection of God's love. With this awareness, they will assume the cross of married life and anticipate whatever difficulties they will later encounter. This will give a depth, purpose and joy to their love that cannot be attained on a purely human level. A third antidote against the dangers that menace love is a sensitivity to the differences between man's love and woman's love. Man's vocation places him at the distracting crossroads of the world. Woman's gift of herself is not harassed by the pull of exteriority. She does not experience man's mental reservations, his doubts or his impetuous egoism. Yet in the silence of her heart she suffers them. Her presence is a reminder to man that no exterior activity can disrupt the interior strength of their love. She continually draws him back to the spiritual sources of their love. Such is the range of conjugal love. It aspires towards the heavens and is chained to the routine of time. It lifts husband and wife to a new level of hope and yet involves them in the torments and conflicts of this life. All of this the Christian couple accepts in the gift of themselves to each other. With a mature realization of the nature of their love, they are prepared to set forth on life's journey. With vision, patience and prayer they fashion the masterpiece of a home and prepare for an eternal reward. Over the years the flame of their love grows brighter, they perceive the image of God in each other more clearly, they grow more interiorly present to each other. The final splendor of human love consists in this, that the bond of love issues forth into the broad stream of divine love. Questions. I. State and elaborate upon the three characteristics of conjugal love. 2. Note some practical examples of the disappointing aspect of love. Is an idealistic attitude a solution to this? 3. What point is the author trying to make by his reference to the play Polyakt? 4. What part does the cross have in married life? 5. Discuss the nuances of love as it is found in husband and wife in relation to their family life. 6. Draw up a point-by-point plan of the advice you would give an engaged couple. Discuss. I. Man and woman aspire to constitute together a perfect society. 2. Love is not the whole of man and woman's life. 3. A man and woman who freely choose one another are united before God. Times 4. The dialogue of husband and wife cannot be interrupted, even when they are physically separated. 5. Whoever wishes to accomplish a work that is fruitful must have in him a large measure of vision, patience and prayer. 6. Perfect marriages have no other history than that of happy people. Chapter EA. Unity in Marriage. Synopsis. The first chapter discussed the broad implications of marriage. Marriage was seen as a unifying state of life which involved both the individual and the community, the human person and the religious person, society and the church. This chapter narrows the discussion to a more detailed examination of the unity that ought to exist in marriage. Greater unity among husbands and wives means greater unity in society, and greater unity in society is the basis for greater unity of all with God. In this way would be realized Christ's great prayer, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, in me, and I in thee. The sources of division in marriage are basically three: when marriage is a union of two egos instead of a vital fusion of two complementary personalities into one we. Secondly, when one personality is so completely absorbed by the other that there is neither two egos nor one we but only one dominant I. Thirdly, when the union is effected in such a way that two personalities are so diffused and compromised as to result only in a weak and ineffective we. The qualities of mind necessary to this pursuit of union are: the firm conviction that this is a difficult undertaking, the equally firm conviction that the basis of this union is a preference of the other's needs over our own personal independence, and the resolution to share our whole life with our partner. This means that husband and wife must work together. They must be sensitive to the needs of the other. They must constantly seek to overcome apathy and routine that threaten this union. They must confide in and be perfectly frank with each other. Both must realize that the union they are striving for is a conquest that must be attempted again and again. They ought never be content with what they have gained, but always endeavor to attain a yet higher union. Above all, both parties must have unflinching faith in the graces of their sacrament, which are far stronger than the divisive forces operating against them. Finally, this unity must be sought at every level of marriage: physical, psychological, and spiritual. This union does not imply identity. On the contrary, each partner must continually enrich his own personal life. The stronger each personality, the greater is the possibility of union that can exist between them. The levels of union may be classified as follows. I. Union of activities. Our activity is part of ourselves. It conditions very deeply what we are and what we are striving towards. To be disinterested in the activity of the other is to be disinterested in the other person, and ultimately, in ourselves. This union of activity must be bomb of circumstances that imply mutual self-giving. 2. Union of bodies. This union comprises a basic harmony between the initiative of man and the submission of woman. Men must not be domineering, woman must not be merely passive. Neither can effect marital union. Where this harmony of bodies is realized, it becomes a strong incentive to union of hearts and souls. It is also the source of abundant graces. 3. Union of characters. This union grows out of the differences of character in man and woman. It also includes defects of character. Faults are not to be loved in themselves, but the other must be loved to the point where his faults set up no enmity between union. 4. Union of hearts. Man and woman do not love in the same way. Neither can expect to be loved as he or she loves. Yet both have a radical need of one another. Patience and gentle frankness is the surest guarantee that these differences will blend, sometimes through misunderstanding and frequently through suffering, into harmony. It is especially in the common love of children that this union of hearts is established. 5. Union of tastes and sensibilities. This union provides many new ways of seeing, feeling, and understanding persons and things. This exchange is a basic source of happiness in the home. The rule of thumb in achieving union of tastes is not to impose our likes on the other, but to find what we enjoy together. Choice of friends is one good example of this union. 6. Union of wills. Marriage is two wills joined together. Husband and wife must be united on essential things first of all. The secret of this union is to have a common objective, to want the same things from life and from marriage. The end we pursue makes us what we are. Serious difficulties can be encountered in this respect, due to the marked difference between masculine and feminine personalities. There is real danger of one partner yielding to the other in pursuit of the union of wills. This can only lead to disaster. The stronger personality ought always play an educative role towards the weaker. 7. Union of intelligence. Neither partner has the right to become isolated in his or her specialty of thought. All intellectual discovery must be shared. Some common intellectual activity, reading, for example, is one means of reaching this union. but there are multiple others.